A wave of shock swept South Africa and the world. 69 people had been killed at Sharpeville, nearly all shot in the back, and hundreds wounded. Would peaceful protest no longer be tolerated? The government then declared a state of emergency, outlawed the liberation movements, and detained over 20,000 people. When Lillian Ngoyi died in March 1980, she was still under banning orders. For most of the 20 years since Sharpeville, Lillian had been silenced and confined to her home. Dora Tamana was detained and spent 5 years under banning orders. Amina Kachalia was banned for 15 years. Helen Joseph was the first person to be placed under house arrest. For 9 years, no one walked down her garden path except the special branch. Helen received her latest banning order shortly after her 75th birthday in June 1980. Frances Bird was detained, banned, spent a year in solitary confinement, and 5 years in jail. On her release, she was banished to Mobopane, 1,000 miles from her home in Port Elizabeth. Having removed the leadership, the government acted quickly to bring the women under control. Every aspect of life was made dependent on the pass. Jobs, housing, schooling, even the purchase of railway tickets and groceries. Finally, in 1963, a full 50 years after the first anti-pass protest, it became mandatory for women to carry passes.
Well, I don't know what you mean, you're tired.
Do you not want to give up?
I can't give up because the spirit is still there. I can't help it even if I want to give up. But the spirit is still there. Although I can't do everything physically, you understand what I mean? But my spirit still wants what I wanted.
Mother Lillian, we shall never forget you, nor shall your name die. You will live in the heart of every newborn child, in the breast of the mother who feeds it, in the arms of the father who will love and protect it. Sleep, Mother Lillian, for beyond the hills a new dawn is breaking, a new order calling the peoples. We'll march together with our sons and daughters, and freedom, like your long-lost lover, will hold you in her arms.
Have to take a few deep breaths whenever I watch it. I've watched it so many times now because it's part of our curriculum at the African Gender Institute in our third year course when you look at feminism and feminist activism. Profile the 1956 march as one of those things that we can engage with and learn from and understand from many, many angles. But today I thought I could highlight some things that always strike me about this story. And the first thing is that in this film it says the passes were first instigated in 1890. If you look at history, the first passes came in 1709, in what we now call South Africa. The term pass was used to describe any document that curtailed an African person's freedom of movement and had to be produced on demand by police or local officials. When there were different kinds of passes over the years of South Africa's colonial history. There were even passes, you know, initially it was about the distinction between the settler community and the local, different kinds of local community, and keeping everyone where they ought to be. Even amongst the settlers, there were certain settlers that were not allowed to move to other areas because it was owned by other settlers. As you know, the Afrikaner and the British tensions also created situations of passes amongst settlers. So South Africa has had a very strong history of passes. And that's a story that, you know, I think we don't really understand the depth of that. You know, sometimes when I look at the bureaucracy in this country, I think it's part of the leftover of the bureaucracy created by apartheid. And, you know, if we had pass systems in 1709, we've got leftovers now in the form of paperwork. We're used to paperwork. So those things, I think about them a lot. Another thing I think about a lot is when we look at, they remember some of them were saying we were inspired by our mothers and our aunties from 1913. The first demonstration that women were involved with en masse was actually in 1913. And at that time, there was the Bantu Women's League, and it was headed by an amazing woman that we don't know much about, we don't talk much about, and she's not talked about in this film. Her name was Charlotte Matseke, M-A-X-E-K-E. And she worked in cooperation with white liberals in the Joint Councils movement. And she headed up the Bantu Women's League way back then, and they were part of organizing in 1913. And so we don't really remember that sometimes. On 9th of August, we think of 1956 as if that was the, you know, but actually those women were inspired by the women of 1913. And when you see another thing that strikes me when I watch this, you can see that there was such a build-up from 1950. And it continued after 1956. The arrest continues. The trial was four years. And even after the trials, there were banning orders. And so it continued and it continued for 50 years. And you can see they were asking Francis, but aren't you tired? Because after 50 years, the pass was reinforced as compulsory. So I think that's something we also tend to forget. You know, sometimes I wonder, Women's Month? Can we say Women's Month? Women's Day? When we look at how far back we can go with the consistent organizing. The other thing that strikes me is the fact that when we're thinking about citizenship and the way citizenship has been created by the apartheid system, a key part, cornerstone of their citizenship, in order to say you're a citizen and you're a native, was this pass law system. The men were born into it, and so they could not even begin to imagine what a resistance would be. It was women who first resisted the pass system in 1913 and again in 1956, and they never stopped. The men only joined officially in 1959. We also forget that. That's something I think that is not doesn't always come out so clearly. And one of the reasons why women were able to organize so well is that the colonial regimes, the apartheid regime, did not target women for labor. They targeted men, right? So the system was targeted at men, so they forgot about the women. So there was less restriction on the women until the passes on women started being instigated. They didn't like the fact that women were following the men, and the economies, the white economies in the urban areas were being strained. They wanted the women to stay with the children in the rural areas and the workers to go to the city. So in the Industrialization Conciliation Act of 1924, defined an employee and excluded all pass-bearing natives. So you could not be unionized if you were pass-bearing because you were not an employee. And who are the ones who could not be unionized? Who had passes? It was men. And so there were more places in which women could actually organize because there wasn't a system yet. But when the system started coming up, they started resisting early, whereas the men were born into it. 1709, they were already being recruited as workers in the colonial regimes. I think what also stands out for me, and it always, you know, makes me smile, even though it's painful, is the fact that the women also demonstrated against beer halls. Isn't that interesting? Because they were not only demonstrating against the whole idea of the pass law system, but they hated the way in which the colonial regime had enslaved their men into a drinking culture that further enslaved them. Because the little money they disappeared for years at a time, they never even saw it. And they just went and attacked all the beer halls. And I don't think that was the first time. And you can find a lot of this information. I've given you some websites, you know, if you want to read more about this. But immediately you can find out about that story. But the one that she spoke of in June 1959 happened in, I think it was KwaZulu-Natal, and there were some other riots going on, as she said, and they took the opportunity to ransack the beer halls. So that's another thing, in that the way in which the women not only resisted the way they were being framed as women who must stay in the Bantustans and be wives, they resisted that. They resisted the colonial notion of what it meant to be a woman and a native, a woman and a citizen. And they challenged that through challenging the power pass laws shoot through not staying in the Bantu areas and going and looking for their men and pulling them out of the hostels and joining them in the hostels, but they also resisted the construction of masculinities. That no, we cannot allow you to become a drinker stroke mine worker. You are more than that. Get out of the beer holes. And so they took on a certain way in which masculinities and citizenship was framed by the colonial apartheid regime. And I find that very intriguing, and there are stories of that across the continent as well. If you look at the charter that they put together, this charter was put in place round about the 1950s when some of the biggest organizing against pass laws took place. And if you look at the content of this charter, which was the basis of the women's charter that was put together later on in the 90s, which was used as a foregrounded, you know, what went into the constitution, it's quite a radical charter. So I just thought I'll give you a copy of it, and so that you can look at, they included their own issues, they included the men's issues, and they included socioeconomic rights. And their framing of socioeconomic rights was around their livelihoods and what it took them to survive and do more than survive but live. And that is what they included in the charter. It's still a radical charter. And lots of this went into the charter that was formed in the 1990s when the Women's National Coalition came about. Some of you know about that. So those are some of the things that I think are quite interesting. I mean, what we don't know enough about is the women who went into Mkonto we Sizwe and the ways in which they negotiated their identities and their femininities and the extent of the violence within the Mkonto we Sizwe amongst comrades. It was very difficult to tell who is with you and who is against you. And how did you negotiate your femininity in a space that was ever shifting? And you're never in one place, and you're carrying things, and you're a messenger, maybe you're this, maybe you're that. How that was negotiated, and the kind of sexual violence that we experienced in MK, we haven't begun to unpack that. And there isn't much writing. You get Robert Suttner? Somebody? Yes. He's began to write about it. So he looks at masculinities in MK and femininities in MK. But I think the femininities in MK, the voices that must speak about that and write about it are not the ones that are speaking and writing about it now. But it's good that, you know, Suttner has started. So that's my two cents. But I really would like to hear from others. Just in case others are about to leave, Bulelwa, maybe you can share. I'd like to introduce Bulelwa Basse. She's, as far as I'm concerned, a young, famous poet. And I went to one of her poetry workshops in Langa, and then I wrote my first poem within hours. And it's still my best poem, so I need to come back for another poetry. But she has a poem she offered to us today, because she heard about this event. And it's called The Women's Journey, Bulelwa. So you can do it now.
Firstly, I'd like to thank you, Ngaliwe, for affording me the opportunity to engage these women. The poem, I just want to give you a little bit of background of the poem which I'm about to share with you. In 1956, but in 2000.
That's what we've got on our mind now.
In 2006, I had the privilege of working with a group of women in media who called themselves Khareya Africa, of which Mamu Kiketso Semoko is one of the directors of that organization. What they did was, they were celebrating the 1956 Women's March, the 50th anniversary. And they got women from different provinces to work within their communities, to work in prisons, to work in nodal areas, to host workshops which facilitated writing workshops. The question which was posed at women was, are we living in the age of hope? And, you know, people had different opinions on whether or not we were actually living in an age of hope. And this poem is a product of that project, which was in commemoration of the 1956 Women's March. And I had the privilege of facilitating that entire process. And so I would like to extend it to you, and as a dedication to each and every one of you. It's called The Woman's Journey. The universe itches at the soles of her resilient feet with its persistent requests. Step by step, she treads tactfully towards the accomplishment of each without a sigh in sound. Even when her shoulders emulate the shape of her burdens, the corners of her eyes crease with a smile whenever she's greeted by the innocence of her kind. Her arms welcoming, her intellect provocative, her tongue gentles enraged hearts, and her beauty silencing. Grown men break into infant tongues in her presence, clumsy over her supremacy. Many have competed and all have self-ridiculed in a quest for her opulence, yet priceless is her worth. Her love is nothing short of God. She seeks connection with every soul she meets. Found love first before knowing who she was. In random tragedy, she learns hard lessons. Through loss of many sentimentals, gains the internal sharpening, and with life's surprising schooling, steps the world with a little bit of wisdom. Her footprints unravel mystery. Her word speaks comprehension, and her exchange revives consciousness. Like stitches in assembly on a quilt, every encounter is history recorded as she journeys with all the living's aspirations, dreams their success, mourns their loss, cries their tears, and fights for the feeble-minded one's sanity. It is this essence of women that propels the world to dreams fulfilled, gives birth to characters of excellence, cultured minds, conquering attitudes, and celebrated spirits. Sorry, I'm emotional. Because hers has always been blessed with the power of building not only a home, but also a nation. She is the perfect poem poetry lovers seek. She is woman, a victor. Not a victim. In Siga is his.
Wow. Wow. That's what Bulelwa does when you go into her workshops. Thank you so much for offering that, and that it comes from a collective energy and wisdom that she facilitated. I think it's very powerful. If there are any questions or discussion here.
Thank you so much. If anybody does need to go, please probably now do feel free. But those of us who might want to just engage with you guys further, I'm sure we'll appreciate it.
If you would like some literature on it, I have a paper here if you have any interest.
What I will also do is I'll put up the links to these things that you've given us onto
yes.
our website so that
okay.
people who weren't here can also
yes.
capture your events. So I don't know if anybody does have any questions.
Kwasi has a hand.
I was watching this for the first time. Thank you.
Okay.
As I'm watching it, I'm thinking about you know during that period of tough and things where the atmosphere is so hostile, but these women, the spirit is so powerful, and they just Bulelwa captured it very well. But I could not help but wonder, sitting there watching that and listening to her, thinking like, what is that spirit?
Do we have it?
Do we still have that? Because I think we still have, because the women were not just fighting about for the past laws, they were also fighting injustice in general during that time. We still have problems and issues and challenges that I think that requires the women's voices and that spirit. But where are they?
That question always comes up when we look at the past activism and get that sense of vibrancy. But before I answer that, I don't have a one-off answer, but I have some points that I reflect on. Anyone else who has some thoughts? Yes, Ariel.
I was invited to a talk last night at the Center for Book and Literature on Ruth First.
Yeah, excellent.
Abby Sachs chaired a presentation talk by Bembiak and Pally Jordan, and it was just so interesting to hear that and come to this. Sorry to catch you, but it's just to really honor and appreciate the women that have come. And one thing that I left with yesterday was that Abby Sachs was talking about there are so many unsung heroes. You know, in the struggle, and people do see and honor and reflect on are collections and collective efforts of people who've come and efforts before them. And I just thought it was really interesting to hear that as well today.
Because you can see all those thousands and thousands of women. They have names, they have stories, they have those energies that poem captures. And those energies, even though they've passed on, they live in us. And when we think about, so where are we at now? There's the Zuma rape trial come and gone. There's Julius Malema's, you know, and certain problematic masculinities out there. There's issues. I mean, I've been teaching this week about, you know, income, poverty, and gender in South Africa. And I can tell you something, and I attended the workers, you know, the cleaners are striking right now. Mm-hmm. 90% of those cleaners are black and colored women. Mm-hmm. And I was dancing with them and whatever yesterday, and we were going up to Bremner Building, and I looked around and I'm like, wow, this could be 1956. Mm-hmm. What's going on? Mm-hmm. What's going on? You know, and I listened to their stories. They fit in this chapter, their story. They need socioeconomic well-being. Mm-hmm. They need to be respected. They've been asked, so super care workers, you should see some of the work they do. They leave the home at 4:30 in the morning in order to get here at 7. No transport provided. Why do they need to get here at 7? Can we not wait for them to come at 9? So they leave when the sun is up? I don't know. They talk about, if you hear their stories, backaches because they lift tables and whatever. Pay cuts because they just didn't turn up or they became a few hours late. They were telling stories of UCT's been putting money on top of their super care salary. They don't see it because half of the 4,000 they get is put into a category called an allowance. And that allowance is dependent on your performance. And they've got a whole list of reasons as to why they won't pay you segments of that allowance. So they were screaming. Few men amongst them too, black men, no white men. And I just looked and I said, wow. I put up my hand. I said, I'm sorry. I am not a super care worker. I teach here, African Gender Institute, and I just want to give you some statistics that I'm teaching in class. Now I'm rushing to class. This is what I'm talking about. And I gave them stats. I said, Professor, that was Dandabantu. I said, Professor, if management wants to do anything, it's now. It's not an accident that all these workers here are women and they are black. It's Women's Month. If there's anything you want to do, please, can you do it now? They've been, though that same list, 6 years, that list. The outsourcing has been confirmed 2 years ago. Tandabantu was saying, now how can I say that we rescind it? You know, it's just, you know what I mean? But the vibrancy and the energy that I'm seeing here, I saw it yesterday morning, without doubt. So it's almost like it's there, but the systems are in place. Whether we call that system patriarchy, capitalism, globalization, economic growth, they are in place. And they didn't, and they thrive on the paperwork, bureaucratic systems that apartheid taught us well since 1709.
So we need more of that vibrancy.
Yeah, it's there. It's there. I mean, if we want to use it, it's there in the poetry. It's there in resistance wherever it manifests, and it manifests often, like in the film. Right now, as we are speaking, those women are dancing. I saw them this morning, moving around campus dancing. You can go and join them and feel that. It's there in the midst of lives you can't even begin to imagine. Still, the demographics are not changing. Poverty has gone down in this country between 97 and 2006 by about 20% or so. It has gone down income poverty. I'm only talking about income poverty. The stats show it's gone down not because of redistribution or employment creation. Income poverty has gone down because of grants. Child grants, pensions, and disability grants. The bulk of those grants are received by women because of gender roles and social histories. But women are still income poorer than men, because if you live off a child grant, your average income, as by 2000 numbers per month, is 142 rands. If you work as a woman, your average income per month is 842 rands. If you're a man, your average income and you're black is 1,300 and something rand. So even though the bulk of the money that's making us less poor, income poor, comes to women, we are still poorer than men, but we are all poor in certain racial categories. And there's not because of redistribution has it gone down, neither due to employment creation, despite RDP and GEAR. Those are the stats I'm working with in class today. My energy is clear. Those women's energy is clear. Our energies are clear. Your energy is clear. So there's hope, I think.
Let's suggest we talk with you one-on-one and we hang around for 5 or 10
okay.
minutes. But let me just now take this opportunity to thank you just for reminding us, for giving us such a personal and vivid way of engaging with us, to bringing Boliwe along just to share that with us. And then also just connecting with us today and where we're at now at UCT.
Thank you.